From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. On today's show, the VA Medical Center teams up with UW-Milwaukee resources to explore mental health issues in LGBT veterans.
Later, writer Marnie Maminga talks about seeing essay material in just about everything around her.
Usually these are ordinary experiences that, just by their simplicity, turn into something profound. They seem to call to me, and I think, what just happened there? And so I am compelled to kind of write it down. So you are kind of on the alert for, does this have some meaning? And if so, maybe I'll start writing it and see where it leads.
And musician and contributor Mike Mangione talks about the hard truth he uncovered in conversation with another Lake Effect regular, singer-songwriter Peter Mulvey.
We then get to the point where we depressingly discuss how utterly replaceable we are as musicians.
Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Veterans' health issues, from physical ailments to post-traumatic stress disorder, are getting much more attention than they used to. Here in the Milwaukee area, most of the care veterans of all ages receive happens through the Veterans Administration and the Clement Zablocki VA Medical Center. But the VA doesn't always go it alone.
This Friday, experts from the VA will team up with the Military and Veterans Resource Center and the LGBT Resource Center at UW-Milwaukee to present their fifth annual Mental Health Summit. It's open to all veterans and the community at large. But this year, the day-long event focuses particularly on issues faced by LGBTQ plus veterans. Joining me in the studio is Raymond Kahns-Krasminski, social worker with the VA, Kimberly Stewart, who's the executive director of the area nonprofit Veterans for Diversity, and Dan Flave Novak, LGBT mental health postdoctoral fellow at the Zablocki VA Medical Center. Well, welcome to Lake Effect. It is a pleasure to have all of you here this morning. Thanks for coming over.
Thanks.
Thank you. No problem. This is quite an interesting summit, and it's quite important that it's happening. It's a really interesting collaboration between the VA and UWM. So let us start with kind of the backstory. How did this come to be? Why was it determined that this was an important mental health summit to have in the community?
Dr. Mike McBride, who is a psychiatrist at the VA, came to me about a year ago and said, you know, we've been doing the mental health summits for the past 5 years, and we really wanted a different topic this year. We've done issues on women's mental health. We've done college students' mental health. And so this year we wanted to focus on the LGBT community. Really, one of the reasons he came to talk with me was because it was we knew that this was going to be the one-year anniversary of the Pulse nightclub shooting. And this issue has really been in the, you know, public's, you know, perception recently. And so he thought that this would be a good time for the VA to really take a stand and let everyone know that the VA is an open and affirming place for all veterans.
And so, Kim, how did you get brought in? Did Dan reach out to you and say, you know, we should do something together?
Actually, one of the other committee members, Rachel Johnson, who also works at the VA, I've worked with her on other projects. She mentioned it was coming, and I was waiting for it to come to fruition. So I was excited until she finally said it is happening. And I really would encourage you to join the board for the committee for the health summit. As a self-identified lesbian and veteran, it was important to have some perspective. So she welcomed me to come aboard, and I've been here ever since.
Why is it so important to reach out to this particular population of veterans? And in what ways has the VA already done that? And in what ways can they improve?
I'm on the LGBT EEO committee. So it's for employees of the VA Medical Center who are looking for LGBT support. It's one of the minority EEO committees on board. And Dr. Mike McBride, who's one of the coordinators for this event, is also on the LGBT EEO committee at the VA, and that's how I got invited to participate. Anyhow, the importance at this time is that the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy just fell not that long ago. And so there are veterans who are seeking care at the VA Medical Center who are still confused about their ability to be open and identify who they are and who are suffering from illnesses and other conditions that they may feel that they can't disclose still because they have many, many years of internalized homophobia and institutionalized homophobia. So now the practitioners at the VA, the patients at the VA really need to be aware of where people are at with their ability to be open about who they are and how to meet patients where they're at with how they treat them. And you know, not everybody is very comfortable running around Pride Fest and parading around there. So there are different levels of being out. And people need to have the ability to disclose who they are when they want to on their terms, as opposed to being outed or gossiped about or those things. So the approach to care needs to be holistic. I mean, that was a very popular term in the early 1970s, and it's got a resurgence again, this holistic care. And holistic care is about mind, body, and spirit. And that's the essence of what this summit is about, to include VA services, community services, and to learn where we need to grow as well at the VA Medical Center.
Now, is this a national project or is this something that this VA is doing?
It's this VA. This is our summit. This is Milwaukee VA Mental Health Summit in conjunction with the University of Wisconsin.
So it
I'm
seems,
correct, right, Dan?
Yes.
Yeah. So it seems like this VA is ahead of the curve.
Oh, absolutely. We're one of nine VAs across the country that have a dedicated LGBT mental health postdoctoral fellow that the job is specifically to cater to the needs, the mental health needs, the holistic health needs of LGBTQ veterans here in the Milwaukee area. I know Chicago has it, Boston has it, some other very large cities have it, but Milwaukee is also ahead of the curve focusing on those issues.
That's a huge ratio. I mean, if you look at all the VA medical centers in the country,
it's
huge. We're in a great position here in Milwaukee and proud of it.
Now, the connection with UWM and with Kim and the program there, is this the thing that kind of was the catalyst that said we can be partners?
UWM has actually been involved with a lot of outreach with the VA and other community nonprofits and veteran nonprofits. The VA realizes that veterans don't come home to the VA. They come home to their families, to the communities. So if we can heal the individual, we can heal those families and the communities. And we need to get these individuals to the VA, whether it's you're a student at UWM and you're a veteran, or you come to Veterans for Diversity. Whatever we do, our job is to advocate, educate, and get you to the VA so you can get the benefits that you deserve and the physical and mental health services that you need that the VA can provide. And being unique to LGBTQ, I do feel embraced when I go to the VA. Seeing the changes over 22 years, this isn't actually something that was embedded in care throughout. I was fortunate to have very LGBTQ-friendly providers most of the time since I've been going to the VA. But to see this explosion, and as Dan mentioned, right now we're getting all this national attention and press about it, and the stigma and oppression isn't going to go away just because the policies and the discriminatory legislation changes. It's still there. And we need to change military culture. We also need to change the culture that the VA is doing. So, you know, I commend them for doing that and reaching out to community partners like UWM and Veterans for Diversity and coming together and to heal our veterans together.
Doesn't UWM have the largest population of veteran students?
You are correct.
Yeah, in the state.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so this is a perfect place for this collaboration to happen. When did Don't Ask, Don't Tell drop? When did that fall away?
2011.
Yeah. Okay, so in the 6 years since, for the two of you who work at the VA, how many LGBTQ plus veterans have started to appear?
They're still scared. They are still scared to come out. And Dan plays a huge role in help educating employees and letting patients know that it's comfortable for them to come out. Also, we struggle with helping straight veterans with their kids who are coming out, or, you know, dealing with those issues and how they're coping with it. And there's huge roadblocks to acceptance.
Is it feeling safer, do you think, for folks? Are they finding themselves saying, yes, this is a pretty safe place for me?
There are some people who think that it's a non-issue, you know, that it really isn't an issue, and sort of kind of get buried in the denial of it all. Whereas other people who do come out and are able to share that certainly know that they're comfortable with it, and you can see people. You know, it's like any LGBT person. You have to test who you're talking to see if you're safe to talk about who you are and be honest with it. So it's like you're always checking out whether this is a safe place or somebody's going to beat me or kill me, you know, those kinds of things.
But I think that at the same time, a lot of the outreach that we've been doing, you know, we do a lot of, you know, electronic bulletin boards around the hospital. We do a lot of outreach events. We have a lot of materials, literature that we distribute throughout the hospital. I think the word is getting out to LGBT veterans that this is a safe and affirming environment. We are seeing more individuals who are coming in for couples therapy, who are coming in for group therapy that we provide, for individual psychotherapy. We have veterans who come in for some of the outreach events that we do around the hospital. So I do think that slowly veterans are starting to recognize that this is a great place to get care.
Since you're a postdoctoral fellow with this, mm-hmm. I mean, all veterans have things that they have in common, mm-hmm. particularly if they've been in war.
Absolutely.
You know, everybody has certain kinds of things that they're dealing with. What do you find that the LGBTQ plus veterans you're dealing with, do they have those things as mm-hmm. well as being afraid of being who they are?
Yeah, absolutely. I would say that, you know, LGBT veterans are dealing with the exact same issues that all veterans are dealing with. I have veterans who are struggling with PTSD, veterans who have depression, anxiety, severe mental illness, you know, body image issues, substance abuse. It runs the gamut. So really, in terms of what I see, it's no different than the rest of the population. Unfortunately, what we see a lot of times is that LGBT individuals have higher rates of mental health issues than the general public. And the reason for that is, you know, there is so much internalized homophobia. There's a lot of discrimination they experience in society. There's a lot of minority stress that they have to deal with. Because of those issues, you know, they're a lot of times really struggling. And being a LGBT veteran, you know, adding that layer of being a veteran, that makes it even harder. It's more of a struggle. And so we definitely do see high rates of mental illness and mental struggles in that community. But in terms of what they're facing, not that much different than other vets.
So let's talk about the summit. Obviously, you're trying to get LGBTQ plus veterans to come to this.
And clinicians and people who are interested in the topic. So everyone is welcome.
And families.
Yes.
Okay. And so is the hope that not only will those people feel welcome, but is like the straight community welcome to learn about
absolutely.
This?
Absolutely. Yeah. Oh, okay. Absolutely. And in fact, essentially, we need to learn more about outreach. And the VA Medical Center needs to learn. And we're looking to this opportunity to learn how we can outreach with the community, with other persons who are interested in providing care. It's not just mental health. It's, you know, primary care is important. LGBTQ people need, you know, to get a flu shot and get a chest x-ray and, you know, maybe get an STI test or something along those lines. You know, so it's about healthcare in general, holistic care, you know, body, mind, and spirit. So, yes, everyone's welcome, please. It's a free event.
When I promote it, I say this is a mental health summit we have every year. It's for all veterans. This year, we have a focus on LGBTQ plus holistic health care. So I invite all veterans to come down because a lot of times, you know, from the therapy dogs to the more specialized sessions on, you know, care that is unique to the LGBT population, there is stuff available for everyone. And, like, every veteran is going to need this. The difference I want to bring up is to me, LGBTQ plus veterans are combat veterans because it's an emotional combat. Mm-hmm. And the invisible war isn't over. And like we're going to find it's generational. We're going to find trickling in. And now that we have our, you know, brothers and sisters that can serve openly, when they come out, I think they're going to change the environment and they're going to bring that awareness and they're going to come flooding to the VA.
So if someone wants to come to this, where do they go to sign up?
Eventbrite. And you can register on site.
And we should say it's at UWM, right?
Yes. In the student union.
In the student union. So in the big ballroom upstairs.
Yes. Right.
We have Jeff Shane coming from San Diego. And he did the Don't Ask, Don't Tell photography series where he photographed 80 active duty reserve and guard members. And he's interviewing those who have served during a Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So from 1994 to 2011, if you want to interview or have the opportunity to interview with Jeff and want to share your story and be asked, just contact UWM Military and Veterans Resource Center, and we'll get you in contact with Jeff so you can participate if you'd like.
I do want to thank all three of you for coming in so early this morning to tell us about this. All of the relevant information will be on our website, WUWM.com. But I can't thank you guys enough for both doing the work and for coming and telling us about it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Dan Flave-Novak is LGBT Mental Health Postdoctoral Fellow, and Raymond Koz-Krasminski is a social worker at the Clement Zablocki VA Medical Center in Milwaukee, and Kimberly Stewart is a graduate student at UW-Milwaukee and executive director of the area nonprofit Veterans for Diversity.
The Zablocki VA Medical Center's fifth annual Mental Health Summit takes place at the UWM Union all day on Friday. It's free and open to the public, and you can find more information at WUWM.com.
Keep listening. We'll take a quick break now, but when we return, a conversation with an Illinois writer whose heart is in the North Woods of Wisconsin. We'll chat with Marnie Mominga when Lake Effect returns on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Writer Marnie Mominga is a Chicago area native, but many of her most touching words are written about her family's cabin in the North Woods of Wisconsin. We spoke with her a few years ago, in fact, about her book, Return to Wake Robin, One Cabin in the Heyday of North Woods Resorts.
Mominga's latest book is a collection of essays that includes more reminiscences of her time in the North Woods, along with the other parts of her life over the years. It's called On a Clear Night, and Marnie Mominga made the trip up to Milwaukee to chat about it. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much, Mitch. It's great to be here. Great fun.
When did you first start writing in essay form?
Well, that's a very good question because I really had no idea what an essay was. And I was an English major in college. I must have written some essays there. But along the personal essay line, I had a series of episodes that I just thought, what do they mean and why are they sticking with me? And so I felt compelled to write them down. And so the first one that I wrote was Passing the Torch, which is about getting up to see the sunrise on the North Woods at our family's log cabin, 1929 log cabin, Wake Robin, which I wrote Return to Wake Robin, one cabin in the heyday of North Woods Resort. And that essay turned into the first chapter of that book. So then I thought, well, gosh, that worked. So I started to send out some more essays, just whatever appealed to me, to different publications, and they started to take hold. And so over the course of about several decades, I've been writing essays and enjoying the process very much.
Do you feel like the process in some way helps you make sense of the things that are going on in your life?
Exactly. I think that for some reason that moment is calling to me, but I'm not sure why. So when I write it and try to describe it, then there's some sort of epiphany along the way that I learn something. And then I hope that what I write others will relate to as well.
Well, and I wondered, since you started writing in that form, you know, over the course of a couple of decades, do you see things, not necessarily, oh, this would be a great essay, but do you, you know, sort of view real life as it goes in a different way than you might without that way to process it?
Well, a little bit, because I think when something happens to something, and usually these are ordinary experiences that just by their simplicity turn into something profound. And they seem to call to me, and I think, what just happened there? And so I am compelled to kind of write it down. So you are kind of on the alert for, does this have some meaning? And if so, maybe I'll start writing it and see where it leads, where it goes.
It's interesting. I've interviewed several doctors who are writers, and they talk about how important it is in a really stressful profession like that to be able at the end of a day or the end of a shift or the end of a week or whatever to be able to sit down just with their thoughts and try to make sense of what has happened. You know, and often what they're doing is life or death. But, you know, there are big things that happen in all of our lives.
Well, they are, and these moments, maybe they're, you know, a big thing like putting a parent in a nursing home, and or waiting for a teenager to come home from a date who's missed his curfew, or maybe something funny like trying to change a tire in a garage floor in the newfangled technology, new improved technology, and so they just kind of call to me, and I write them down, and it's fun to explore and see where they go. And I do think it's kind of a release of your emotions and good exploration of the experience. So I enjoy it.
What was it like going through all of these writings and trying to put them into a coherent book?
Well, it was fascinating because I wondered what they would look like in a manuscript. And interesting enough, they fell into these natural themes or patterns of family, friendships, nature, life changes, challenges. And it was interesting to discover the number of themes that kept repeating themselves and seemed to be important to me.
So, such as?
Well, certainly family and also life changes, you know, switching careers, leaving, kids leaving, parents leaving, friends leaving through illness or change of vocation. A lot of that had seemed to have a big effect on me. And I write about that a lot, the beauty of nature that surrounds us and how that impacts our daily lives. So,
was it a little like when you went back through these, is it a little like going back through a photo album?
It is. And I do have a lot of photos that would go with those essays, but it is like going through a photo album. And at the time, a lot of the time I wrote about getting older, middle age, or learning to dance when you were middle age, or losing a friend, you know, as you get older. And those sort of things, I look back now and I'm going, gosh, I was really young. Why was I focused on that aging? But that sense of moving forward through life, I think, is like a photo album, a memory, a strong memory.
When do you write? When is the time right for you to sit down and actually, you know, crank out 1,000 words?
Well, I wish I could be one of those writers that said that I had a daily schedule and I, you know, the seats in the chair from 9 to 5. And or I write at the coffee shop, but I'm not. I'm just a sporadic writer. I do my best work in the morning. I think I do my best thinking out for a walk or driving in the car, like coming up today. And so discipline and perseverance are really key. And sometimes a little short on that, but I do stick with it. So it gets done because I want to finish it and see where it leads.
As you go back through old writings and put them all into one coherent collection, is there a temptation to go back and change things?
You know, it was kind of fascinating to see that, no, I think that what I wrote kind of rang true, and I didn't really want to change too much. And I'm grateful my editor, a wonderful editor with Wisconsin Historical Society Press, did not either. But it was wonderful to have her vision as well, Elizabeth Wyckoff, and to see what transpired. So I did not. I felt that it was really true to the emotions that I felt at the time, the picture that I wanted to paint. And that's what I wanted to capture, that truth.
I always, you know, I've asked this question of musicians in the past when they, you know, are you know, thinking about this new album they have out and it's their, you know, 14th or 15th, and they go back and look at what they did 20 years ago or 15 years ago. Do you look back and have to be sympathetic at the writer you were in those days? Not that you weren't a good writer, but you're definitely a different writer the longer you do it. I wonder how Marnie Mominga today views the one who started writing 20, 25, 30 years ago.
Well, I think you end up with a lot more confidence. I think you start out not knowing where that essay is going to go, or that piece of music that you've composed is where will it land? Will there be an audience? Will it ever be published? And so when those things start to happen, that gives you a little more confidence to keep going and to see what might transpire. And so it is, in a way, it's kind of self-encouragement, like, oh, that worked. Okay, I'll keep going. And it makes you want to take a little more risk, a little more step out there a little bit more and see where that leads as well. So it's a very creative and interesting journey that's very fulfilling.
When you're working on an essay and you're writing it and you're polishing it, how do you know when you're done?
Well, I am a person who rewrites and rewrites and rewrites. So I am nitpicking those words over and over and again. And finally, when I think I have a sense of peace, like I feel this is okay, I read it out loud. How does it sound? And you always are thinking, oh, should I change that word? I change that phrase. But in the end, I think you just know instinctively you're done. And at some point, you have to put it down and send it off. And that's that trust that you have to kind of, and that letting, I write a lot about letting go of them particularly. And that's not easy to do. So that's where the trust comes in.
Well, I'm going to want to have you read one of these essays for us in just a moment. But before we get to that point, let me say congratulations. This is a terrific collection, and we're thrilled that you are able to share some of it with us.
Oh, thank you so much, Mitch. I love being here, and I'm thrilled to be invited to be back. Thank you.
All right. And so you mentioned one of the essays in the interview, and it is one that I had actually dog-eared, and it is the one about changing a tire because maybe I'll have you say a little bit more about what inspired that. Obviously, there was an event that inspired that, but what were you trying to capture with
this
essay?
Well, that's entitled Owner's Manual. And actually, that is one of my favorites. I write a lot about, there's a whole section on kind of technology and my aversion to it. So when we had to change a tire on these new cars that are supposed to be new and improved technology, it was quite an adventure and frustrating one. I'm very experienced at changing tires the old way, the old-fashioned way with a jack and a, you know, a wrench. And we did that for years as children, driving up to the North Woods, watching my dad do it. We did it as teenagers ourselves. So this was a whole new experience. Thankfully, the tires don't go flat. That's a new improve that often. But when they do, it is a nightmare. So that is how this story came to be. Owner's Manual. It was a dark and stormy night. Or at least in my nightmares, it seemed that way. Actually, it was a bright and sunny day when our tire blew out. If it had been a dark and stormy night, we would have really been in trouble. It was difficult enough trying to figure out how to assemble the jack, locate the spare, and find the axle in broad daylight. Current car commercials make one think that the technical engineering of our automobiles would put them right up there with the Mars spacecraft. Alas, somewhere along this high-tech pursuit, someone forgot about keeping the jack and spare tire instructions simple. After our recent experience, I'd put changing a tire right up there with solving a Rubik's Cube. Setting off on a 20-mile trip to town from our cabin on a beautiful fall day in northern Wisconsin, my husband and I heard a weird noise coming from the right side of our car, as if we were dragging a big stick. For once in our lives, we decided not to ignore a car sound we could not identify and stopped to take a look. To our surprise, the back right tire was flatter than a run-over penny on a train track. Turning the car around, we slowly drove the half mile back to the cabin where we would be able to change the tire on the garage floor's hard surface. At least we knew that much. Like a SWAT team, the two of us searched the car for the jack and spare tire to no avail. Finally, my husband discovered the jack, located in a cleverly camouflaged compartment beneath the second row seat. It consisted of four skinny pipes that looked like Tinkerbell's wand had been in a fight and lost. My husband and I looked at each other in dismay. How the heck did this contraption fit together, and where in the world did it jack up the car? It was time to pull out the owner's manual. Oh, the shame of it, the shame. What dignified, self-respecting person ever reads the owner's manual? And while I'm at it, Whatever happened to the good old days when a jack was a jack? In our defense, we are not tire-changing neophytes. We changed our first tire together as dating teenagers on another deserted Wisconsin road in the middle of a forest with only the starlight to guide us. We found the escapade hilarious. My parents, understandably, did not. In addition, I am a veteran witness to tire changing, having grown up in the 1950s when my family of seven experienced a tire blowout on virtually every annual summer vacation to the North Woods and back that I can remember. Sooner or later, on our 450-mile odyssey, the familiar thumpity-thump-thump would resound through the open windows of our packed-to-the-brim station wagon with a canoe on top. With a few swears under his breath, my father would deftly pull the car to the side of an empty country road where a cluster of cows served as our only company. But we didn't panic. We had this tire-changing nailed, so to speak. Our biggest challenge was to untie the canoe from the top of the car and unload all the luggage and vacation paraphernalia from the back end of the station wagon in order to retrieve the jack and spare. Back then, even kids knew the spare tire's location. All jacks basically looked the same and always fit next to the wheel well. And no one needed an owner's manual to assemble them, nor was there one even if you'd wanted it. With a few good cranks of the jack, the car rose up faster than a phoenix out of the ashes. A couple of good twists of the wrench, and the bolts came flying off. On went the spare, back went the bolts, back went the belongings in the canoe, and we were back on the road in a matter of hours. Child's play. Unfortunately, the old adage, "Don't fix what ain't broken," got overlooked in the computer age tire tune-up department. And so I have to admit, we opened the owner's manual to the index and looked up jack, page 342. In a flat and halting voice that sounded like Frankenstein's, I slowly read the instructions out loud to my husband. Assemble the jack and jacking tools as shown. Connect jack handle driver A to two extensions B, then to the lug wrench C. Now, ours is not a fancy car. It is a basic American-made model, a medium-sized SUV, but I'll be danged if we couldn't identify the axle where we were instructed to fit the jack because there was so much metal hanging beneath the carriage of the car. Before long, we two grandparents, college-educated with master's degrees, were slithering under the car on the sandy garage floor like a couple of snakes. "I think I found it," I shouted. "Look at this picture on page 344. It matches." We were so happy, we thought we'd won the lottery. Luckily, in our search beneath the car, we also discovered the spare tire. What genius decided to hide it down there is beyond me, because our next quandary was how to disengage it. Back to the owner's manual, page 340. The spare tire is stowed under the rear of the vehicle by means of a cable winch mechanism. To remove or stow the spare, use the jack handle to rotate the spare tire drive nut. The nut is located under a plastic cover at the center rear of the cargo floor area, just inside the lift gate opening. There you have it. Easy as pie. As a bonus, there were enough caution warnings surrounding every direction that I felt I was entering Bill O'Reilly's no spin zone. Somehow, we figured it out, and slowly, slowly, the spare tire floated down beneath the car like a spaceship twirling in an outer galaxy. Our sense of being in the twilight zone was complete. Eventually, we accomplished our task. The manual's parting note was to stow the tire beauty side up. This must have been an inside joke, because, believe me, if there was a beauty side to the tire, I failed to recognize it. Gratefully, we were soon back on the road to town where the nice tire man informed us that our flat tire was ruined. When he replaced the spare a few days later, I watched in wonder as he whipped that tire off and put on the new one in a matter of minutes. Of course, he was using a power jack that would have shot our 2-ton car to the moon. I put one on my Christmas list. Yet, like all good nightmares, mine was not over. Recently, I bought a car seat for my two infant granddaughters, and a few mind-boggling attempts to connect it properly, I was beginning to think the tire changing looked easy. As frustrated as a 2-year-old and in fear of going ballistic, I once again succumbed to the instruction manual. Imagine my horror when I read, check vehicle owner's manual for the vehicle top tether anchor locations. They may be identified using one of the anchor's symbols, figure B or figure C. Pass the Tylenol.
That was Marnie Mominga reading her essay, Owner's Manual. It's taken from her latest book, which is called On a Clear Night, Essays from the Heartland. It's published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. Her previous book was called Return to Wake Robin.
Mominga will chat about the book and her writing tonight at Books & Company in Economowoc. There is a link to more from WUWM.com.
We'll take one more break and then check in with the alliterative Milwaukee musician Mike Mangione, who shares highlights from his podcast with us each month. You're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tine.
And I'm Bonnie North. Milwaukee area musician Mike Mangione plays on stages around the world, both headlining and sharing the limelight with other musicians. But in his spare time, some of those other musicians and other artists share their lives with him in a podcast series he calls Time and the Mystery.
In turn, Mike joins us every month to share parts of those conversations. Today, he brings us a conversation with a guy we've had plenty of conversations with as well. Mike Mangione, welcome back to Lake Effect.
It's pretty good to be here.
So you bring us a lot of conversations in this segment with people that we would love to have in the studio someday, but we have never. Mm. But for today...
Special day.
Because
Milwaukee day.
You have, it's very meta. You have spoken with someone who has been a fairly frequent guest on Lake Effect over the years, Peter Mulvey, Milwaukee singer-songwriter.
Staple.
Yes. And a good friend of Lake Effect and a good friend of yours.
Yep.
So I'm curious to get your take on the kinds of things that you talked about that we might not talk about in, you know, I hate to use this term, just another studio session with Peter Mulvey. You, as a musician, speaking with a musician, got into kind of almost a generational conversation.
Yeah. So there was a unique guest for me because not only are we friends, but also we have a history together in our home, you know, where we're from. And so, you know, right away, I start telling, and that's the nice thing about these interviews is I get to say things I never would say to them anyway. So I said, hey, you know, Peter, you know, we just discovered that you're 10 years older than me. When I was at Marquette University, I remember you and Willie were like the guys ahead. And I remember like just being inspired by Willie Porter, by being inspired by what you guys were doing. And we start talking about like the Milwaukee lineage, and he, you know, Paul Sebar inspired Willie Porter and Peter Mulvey inspired Chris Porterfield and me. And then now we have like the, you know, Trapper Shep and Brett Newsky. And so, you know, there's just this lineage of like 10 years, everybody's 10 years just kind of looking up the ladder. And we then get to the point where we depressingly discuss how utterly replaceable we are as musicians and, you know, ultimately human beings. No, as musicians. We're not replaceable as human beings, as musicians.
I utterly concur. I mean, first of all, it's more beautiful to view it that way, and it'll be more fun and more fulfilling to view it that way. But I've had that brought forcibly home to me twice in two very different sets of circumstances. A friend of mine, Anais Mitchell, who's a great, great songwriter, and she wrote this thing called Hades Town. She started it as a play.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a retelling of the Orpheus myth, of the old Greek myth.
You did this in Cambridge.
Yeah.
Okay, you told me about it.
Right, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So my pal Anais Mitchell, she is a steam shovel of an artist. Like, she got a hold of this thing, and she wrote this whole play, this folk opera based on it. Mm. And then that got turned into a record. Greg Brown played Hades, perfect Hades.
Yeah.
So they did this record, and the record had its life in the sun. And then she took to touring it, and she would just go to a town and assemble the local singers. So in Boston, I got to be Orpheus.
Yeah.
And there was an orchestra, you know, trombones and violas and violins. And we we performed the songs without really the acting and the libretto, and it sold out. It was just people jammed around us. Mm. And it's some of the most powerful artwork that I've ever been in, you know, like everyone sang their roles really well, and it's a cosmic bit of writing. But it was on the third day, I'm sitting there amongst all these artists that I totally revere. Like, I love every artist that was involved in it. And it suddenly struck me, we're in Harvard Square. Mm. There's been a university. There's been a university in on this location for 400 years. Mm-hmm. We're not the first people to take the Orpheus myth and make art out of it.
Right.
You know, like Aeneas is probably in that time span, it's probably like the 8th, 9th, 14th person to really kick that piece of art back up into combustion.
Yeah.
And I had this eerie sense of like how replaceable I am.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the exact same feeling that I had from a little while back when I was playing a farmer's market. So I go and I set my little lamp down and I'm in the corner of this market and there's all these farmers, some of whom are, you know, Hmong, and some of whom are like rural, I guess they're all rural Wisconsin people, mm-hmm. but some of whom would be recognizable as rural Wisconsin people 100 years ago, and some of whom are startling new additions, but undeniably, the farmers, the land, the market, the people, everyone's walking around, little kids in strollers, and I'm just some dude singing songs. Like, it's not my show. It's not about me.
Yeah.
And I had that same feeling, like, this guy that I'm being for these 2 hours, this has been happening for 6,000 years. This happened in Sumeria. This happened in Kazakhstan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this happened in Ethiopia. Like, the people on the land get the food from the land and bring the food to the village. And then the villagers walk around and some yahoo sings some songs. And
some minstrel.
All, right.
Entertain us.
Right. I love that feeling. Not only am I insignificant, I'm just an iteration. Like, you could just plug me into any slot. It's fine.
So, oh, man. I'm, like, getting scared of my own skin now. I'm like, so, all right.
So aside from this notion of being replaceable as musicians, you tend to ask people some bigger, more heavy philosophical questions, although I guess that's heavy and philosophical in its own way.
It's not very difficult with Peter Mulvey, and that's why I was so excited to actually have this amount of time with him. And he is just he's a deep thinker, and he's aware. And so we got to a point where we right away started talking about like specifically in this segment, we're talking about compassion and honesty, which he's saying is more important than the traditional good and evil, left and right. Like, things can be too polarizing, and there's a bigger narrative that we need to understand if we're actually going to have a conversation with each other. And so what I love about this is that it shows you guys, like, this depth that he goes in his music is how he goes in his conversation, is how he is in his heart, is who he is as a person. And so I wanted to share this part because it just kind of shows the Peter that we all love, you know.
I mean, I go in with my idea that I want to reach people and I want to connect. And I want to – the two things that most concern me in life are compassion and honesty. And I feel like those – we're always going to be tugged between two things.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like being tugged between good and evil – is not as helpful as being tugged between compassion and honesty.
Hmm. Well, explain. What do you, speak into that a little bit.
Because good and evil they're just not very reliable. I don't think there's a lot of real evil in the world.
Hmm.
You know, I mean, maybe that's the best way to put it. Like I'm a political lefty for whatever that's worth in the United States of America for whatever that's worth. I don't think Trump is evil. I don't think Bush is evil. I don't even think Cheney's evil, although on my bad days I would be convinced.
Mm-hmm.
The reason I don't think that is I don't think it's very useful to think that.
Mm-hmm. You think it's polarizing to have such?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Precisely.
Yeah, yeah.
Like as soon as there's a them and they're evil, whatever they are, like if you're a liberal, then maybe the conservatives are evil. If you're a Brewers fan, maybe the Cubs are evil. Like this
it's
does
dangerous.
Not it right. And it and you see it all over. Like the, you know, where it all dies is when the police consider criminals evil.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And look, it's hard to be a cop. Yeah. I'm sure. But once you consider a group of people as evil or even potentially evil, you're lost. You can't help them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, similarly, it's not going to help you if you think cops are evil. I think we just get hung up on in-group and out-group.
I know what you're saying, that it can be it's like saying left and right. You know, for political, like, I can't stand those terms because it's you're talking about beliefs, not like sides.
Yes.
You know, and so when you set these two sides and it's like, which one are you?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's like, I don't think like that. You know,
yes.
I what topic do you want to talk about? Let's have a conversation and see, you know, see where I fall.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's a tension between good and evil, but I think that tension hurls us into storytelling.
Mm.
And that storytelling doesn't really have a good editor and doesn't have a good fact checker. And all of a sudden, we're the good guy. I mean, have you noticed how often you're the good guy?
I'm always the good guy.
Right. And I'm always the good guy.
That can't be possible.
Exactly. But if you look at honesty and compassion,
mm-hmm.
and you ask yourself to resolve those tensions, I feel like now we're just intrinsically going to get further.
All right, you're having this musician-to-musician conversation with Peter Mulvey. Mm. Where else did the conversation go?
Well, it went everywhere, Mitch, as you will discover. But I wanted to share this one because it's one of my favorite. They're all my favorite episodes, but like this one.
Like, which is your favorite child, right?
I love Peter Mulvey. I just do, you know, and I love my goal with this podcast is to share with other people that I love and their hearts. And so we get to a conclusion that is a source of release for us. And then I just blatantly say, what do you want out of your work? What do you want people to get? And he shares just a beautiful answer. And I think it's a fitting end to this segment.
You know, so you've brought me to a conclusion, which I'm seeing now clearly for the first time, which is if we are talking about economic justice or social justice, our heroes are the comedians.
Yeah.
Like Jon Stewart and John Oliver and Samantha Bee and Larry Wilmore. Like those are the people who have leverage on those things. If we're talking about heart-to-heart justice, mm-hmm. that's where musicians can, because comedy is a language of the gut and the head, mm-hmm. and music is a language of the heart.
The heart.
There, we said it.
Oh, my gosh. All right. Well, then in one short answer, then, I love humans that realize that they're part of something bigger.
Yeah.
And you're working in a way, from my vantage point, that appears to be you're aware of that there's something bigger, and you're shoveling your coal into that fire. You know? What do you want, then, for people take away from that work, that coal?
Hopefully that I'm just like them. You know, I'm trying to be all right. I'm trying to be happy. I'm trying to be an all right guy. And I think everyone is exactly there. I really do.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that they see themselves in my songs and see that I see them in my songs. Mm. That's all. You know, like we get to come together. It's almost just like a little check-in, and it's a check-in that's sort of implicit rather than an explicit. It's like what an AA meeting does for a lot of people, and what church does for a lot of people, and what a good, strong friends network, you know, like real friends do for each other, where like you don't even have to say that you're checking in, but you're kind of all just coming together. And we're trying.
Yeah.
We're trying. How's it? Okay, good. Yeah. Doing all right. Good. All right. Good.
Donuts in the basement.
Donuts in the basement. Go in peace. You know, yeah. That thing.
Yeah.
That thing. That. I mean, it's just the human thing, you know, try to help each other through the dark a little bit.
Well, I feel like it's only fitting that we go out with a tune that the two of you actually recorded together. Mike, thanks so much. Tell us what we're hearing.
Well, thanks for having me. It's always nice to be here. And so this is, I have an EP that just came out called the 3 Days EP, and you know, it's four songs, and one of the songs was a song that Peter and I did together. It's actually a Peter Gabriel cover, and I heard this song I was singing one day, and I heard Peter singing the female part, the Kate Bush part. And so this is a song called Don't Give Up, and it's done by Peter Mulvey and I.
Mike Mangione is a Milwaukee area musician, and he's the host of a podcast called Time and the Mystery. He brings us highlights of that podcast every month. He'll do more playing than talking on stage tomorrow night, however, at Linneman's.
This proud land, we grew up strong. We were wanted all along. And I was taught to fight, taught to win. I never thought I could fail. No fight left, or so it seems. I am a man whose dreams have all deserted. I've changed my face, I've changed my name. No one wants you when you lose. Don't give up, 'cause you have friends. Don't give up, you're not beat. Don't give up. I know you can make it good. Oh, I saw it all around. Never thought that I could be affected.
And that's the Wednesday edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. We have some exciting news for our listeners who can't always make it to their radios at 10 a.m. on weekdays.
Don't give up. The Lake Effect Nighttime Rebroadcast is returning. Starting Monday, July 3rd, you'll be able to hear Lake Effect at 10 in the morning and 10 at night, followed both times by Fresh Air at 11.
Plus, we'll still be on the air at 3 p.m. on Saturdays and Sundays. Thank you so much for tuning in today. Do join us again tomorrow morning at 10 for Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. It's NPR in Milwaukee.
It's 11 o'clock, and keep listening. We're about an hour away from the latest news headlines from NPR and WBUR in Boston on Here and Now. But right now, Fresh Air comes your way next.
Don't give up. Somewhere there's a place where we belong.